Hello there. We're trying to keep Choral Chihuahua going, and so we draw your attention to the possibility of listening to us on Patreon for just a few quid a month. This also magically gets rid of the ads. That's Patreon with an E, patreon.com/choralchihuahua. On with the app.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Choral Chihuahua.
Second inversion chords. Second inversion chords.
And we had these two episodes about Bach with Eamon and Sammy, but of course the BBC Singers thing happened, and so we put that episode together. And of course there's been somewhat of a reprieve in the last couple of days, but everyone's left wondering, well, does this now mean a private solution, which shouldn't be what the BBC is about? My own view is that if it is, that's maybe not what it should be, but it actually might make them stronger. I just think they should be allowed to market themselves, because they do such interesting stuff, and yet one really rarely hears about them unless one actually is madly following them, and they do such interesting music. Anyway, if you haven't heard that last ep, it's a really good introduction to the variety of the things that the BBC do. I saw someone on Twitter just now moaning about the King Singer's new Disney album and say you shouldn't pander, and you know, someone else saying it's a zero-sum game. Of course you should do everything, and that's, we should be so impressed with the way British groups, you know, the top ones, seem to be able to do all these different things. And that last episode of ours just showed the sort of variety of the BBC Singers. I think the problem's a much bigger one, and I think the reason people got so exercised about this BBC Singers thing was because it seemed to be so indicative of how classical music seems to be valued much less by people who are making decisions. Well, of course it is. If 40 years ago you stop supporting music in state schools, then you are going to grow up with a class of managerial people who weren't exposed to it in school. And with all the extraordinary work going on with individual charities and music hubs around the country, you know, if I talk to other professionals, they say, wouldn't it just be easier to value it in the schools again? Anyway, so we'll get on to Bach now with Eamon and Sammy, but it's a big shout out to all music teachers, state schools, private schools, all of you, but especially the ones at state schools. If you're not feeling valued, we value you. Keep doing what you're doing, please, for our kids' sake and our kids' kids' sake. And for everyone's sake, really. It civilizes us all. Profound thought there. Over to Bach. Eamon and Sammy were mid-sentence talking about the chorales and what they do for the pacing of the whole thing. So back to these two old windbags.
And you need those moments of space, don't you? Because actually, I mean, these are pieces that we know well. And even within this, I look for those moments of calm almost that come, you know, with the chorales. It's like a moment of breathing space. James McMillan talks about the silences in his music being almost as important as the notes on the page. And I know you like that Mozart quote about it's the space between the notes, which is where the music lies. There's so much in this music that my brain at least can't process it, and I need the space that these chorales afford.
That's exactly right. And one imagines that part of the problem with the initial reception of the John, for example, is just that it's too much for a listener to take on in one hearing. it's also worth remembering that we, you and I, and those of us who have the fortune to spend time with this music, have done these pieces much more than Bach did.
Yeah.
You know, he played the John, we think, maybe four or five times, the Matthew, we think, maybe twice, which is kind of mind-blowing.
That is mind-blowing. I mean, you know, what a privilege for us, but it kind of must have been heartbreaking for him in a way to have, I mean, the care that he put into them, and as the manuscript of the Matthew is this incredible sort of, almost like a, he wanted this, you know, the, this copy to be, you know, this was like the final version. You mentioned that the John was revised, you know, four times, I think, or at least there are four. Is it four versions of it?
Yeah, so, I think so.
You know, we get to revisit this and immerse ourselves in it all the time.
Such a fortune, such a, you know, such a privilege. The other thing about that is that, you know, this reworking that we talk about, it's so unusual for him not to rework something. He was completely inveterate, really, as an adopter and adapter of material. And the fact that the Matthew doesn't get that treatment, I think, is really telling. Is feels like a particularly special thing. Like you say, the manuscript itself is this artifact, really. But also the fact that this idea of the composer as kind of creator, it's slightly more 19th century idea. So Bach wouldn't, the idea of the composer being omnipotent or even superior being as a creator was not just not invented yet, it was also heretical. There was only one creator, and that was all of these things, like the dedication in all his scores is Soli Deo Gloria. All of this stuff was done to the glory of God. I wonder if he would have been heartbroken about not doing the pieces, or whether he just thought, well, that's another thing that's gone on the sort of stream of prayer.
The complexity in Bach's music, is that part of the praise of God? The more, I mean, these works particularly, he didn't write anything really bigger than these, other than, you know, let's say the B minor Mass. You know, they're approaching that. Certainly the John was the biggest thing he'd ever written at that stage in his life. The scale, the magnitude, the complexity of the music, all of the connections that you've mentioned, the nature of the sort of palindrome of the structure of the John. Is this all part of Bach's aspiration to create something which is so extraordinary that therefore his praise of God is greater and more sincere?
I think that's exactly it, isn't it? It's just that you think of the supreme architect, and he would have recognized that as God, and this is a way of dedicating his own work in that way. Structurally, they're amazing. That, you know, the Matthew and the John, in very, very different ways, you know, that are put together with incredible invention and incredible inspiration and just even technique, really, to the extent that, you know, you or I doing it for the 54th time still find new ways that things are connected and linked, and new threads to find our way through the piece. But yeah, I think Luther said that next to the word of God, music deserves the highest praise. And that's, Bach is almost the embodiment of that.
Nick, that's yourself and the Dunedin consort again there. Another brutal interjection, that time from the Matthew, and coming out of the most beautiful soprano aria, Aus Liebe, just like in the St. John, the sort of balm, if you like, of the aria is not allowed to linger.
There's a school of thought that says that's one of the most shocking parts of Western music up to that point. It's, Aus Liebe is a very, very sort of tranquil aria, really, in A minor, just a flute and two oboes, the catcher and a soprano. No bass, so incredibly ethereal and sort of heaven-looking, answering the question as to why Jesus suffers, and perhaps why humanity suffers, because of love. And straight out of that, as quickly out of that as you want, really, you get this diminished chord and the crowd straight away baying again for Jesus' blood, for him to be crucified. It's extraordinary, really, and it speaks to Bach's kind of understanding, I think, of how we next to the sublime, we have human fault and human suffering and human stupidity and futility.
This might be a moment to lower the tone and offer a little bit of levity. I can remember being told about one of the Plainsong passions, you know, going back several centuries, when what's the line about he was given the vinegar to drink?
Yeah,
and so they put it on a hyssop. What's the line in there, sir?
So after Jesus had drunk the vinegar, he gave up the ghost and said, and he says, "It is finished, Ed."
Yeah.
And then the evangelist sings, "I didn't know they made vinegar in Finland, and don't call me Ed."
Maybe, maybe not.
Could be apocryphal, who knows?
Yeah, indeed. If you will let this man go.
That's right. Yeah,
that's the other one, isn't it? Yeah. So there, there we have an example in the John of this sort of the brutality that, that Bach's prepared to put into the narrative and in his music, and it's there in the Matthew as well. So there are, of course, similarities inevitably between the pieces. In terms of the scale, the John is much, it's on a much smaller scale. I mean, in terms of forces, I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
The Matthew has a, I mean, for starters, it's in two choirs and two orchestras, which is pretty radical, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah, I think it's unusual, certainly, if not sort of revolutionary, and it allows again this further layers and further kind of constructions of meaning within the piece. So I think the it's often choir two, for example, that is asking the question, that is playing the slightly more in the dark believer. So they're always asking where and when and what's happening. There's a sense of kind of education even within the music itself, and of persuading and allowing them to see the story unfolding perhaps more in real time.
Is there a feeling that the John is the poor relation to the Matthew?
Not for me, but I maybe, I mean, the Matthew is so great. You know, the C.P. Bach called it the Great Passion. You know, it was quite quickly known as Bach's finest work before falling out of use, really. But I just think they're very, very different things. I think that they do different things, and the differences are really illuminating. I think it's really worth thinking about that. I love them both. I really more than I should.
Yeah, I mean, you asked me before we started recording, you know, which one's my favourite. I can't answer that question, and I won't answer it.
Go on.
Many years ago, worked with a great man called Roger Allen, who used to be director of music at the choir school at New College, and went on to be fellow in music at St. Peter's College. Bach and Wagner were his two greatest passions, and every year he would conduct a performance of the Matthew. And I can remember him saying to me that in his mind, that the John was kind of an extended cantata, if you like, but the Matthew was a much more deutscher work. That was the phrase that he used.
Lovely. Yeah, I think that's true. The Matthew feels like a slightly more separate entity to the cantatas, partly because of the double chorus thing, which only happens very rarely in the cantatas, partly because of the scale of it, the length of it even, partly as well because of the way that Jesus in the Matthew has this sort of crown of upper strings that kind of give him a sense of divinity musically, which I think is really worth thinking about. The John uses the same forces really as a regular Sunday cantata. So I can understand that, yeah.
You mentioned the halo of strings that people talk about with Christ. Let's just hear a little bit of that.
Er antwortete und sprach, ihr mit der Hand mit mir in die Schüssel taubet, ihr wird mich verraten, des Menschen Sohn geht zwar dahin, die von ihm geschrieben steht. Doch wehe dem Menschen, durch welchen des Menschen Sohn verraten wird. Es wäre ihm besser, dass derselbige Mensch noch nie geboren wäre. antwortete Judas, der ihn verriet, und sprach: Bin ich's, Rabbi? Er sprach zu ihm:
Du sagest.
Da sie aber aßen, nahm Jesus das Brot, dankete und brach's und gab's den Jüngern und sprach:
Nehmet, esset, das ist mein Leib.
Und er nahm den Kelch und dankete, gab ihnen den und sprach:
Trinket alle daraus, das ist mein Blut des Neuen Testaments, welches vergossen wird für viele zur Vergebung der Sünden. Ich sage euch, ich werde von nun an nicht mehr von diesem Gewächs des Weinstocks trinken, bis an den Tag, da ich's neu trinken werde.
Previous guest on Choral 2 Hour, the great Matthew Brook singing the Rod of Christ there with my colleague for the day, Nicholas Mulroy, and the Dunedin Consort directed by John Butt. The dream team there for me, you and Matthew.
Too kind. I've had great fortune to sing these pieces with, you know, lots of great colleagues, including yourself, but there is something about the way Matthew does it that I find very, very, very moving.
We were talking about some of the similarities between the John and the Matthew a moment ago. Let's look at some of the differences which we've touched on in terms of the scale of the Matthew. In terms of structure, we have the same sense of the narrative propelled by the evangelist, with the chorus having the role of the crowd, and then we have the arias as like the illumination, if you like. But in the Matthew, before most of the arias comes an arioso to like almost to set the scene for the aria.
Yeah, it's like another level of statement, really, another level of speech in a way. It allows us. There's a stronger sense, I think, in the Matthew that what's happening with the narrative and with the reaction to the narrative is a kind of immediate activation of both the voice of God or the voice of the gospel and a kind of reaction, a human reaction in real time to it. In the John, it feels slightly less human than that somehow. I can't explain quite why. But these ariosos give us a sense that we grow into reflection rather than just kind of reflecting straight away.
Let's listen to an example of one of these arioso, I'm not sure.
Ariosi?
Ariosi.
That's plural.
Anyway.
One of these.
One of them. This is coming right towards the tail end of the Matthew.
Yeah, it comes before the final aria, which is Makkadich. Quite a lot to say about that, I suppose. Makkadich is in B flat major, which is as far from the E minor of the first chorus as it's tonally possible to get for Bach. So there's a sense of a real transformation, a real transfiguration of what the music has achieved and the narrative has achieved for us. And the arioso that comes before it is, for me, it's one of the most extraordinary things he wrote. I love Makkadich, and it always finishes me off, really. But the arioso, just as a distillation of kind of theological thought and of music and its capacity. And also it takes the crown of strings that perhaps the same singer would have had singing Christus Christus is now dead, but the singer takes on the role of reflecting on Christ's life with the same orchestration, which I think is there's something quite poignant about that.
Am Abend da es kühle war, ward Adams fallen offenbar. Am Abend drücket ihm der Heiland nieder. Am Abend kam die Taube wieder und trug ein Ölblatt in dem Munde. O schöne Zeit, o Abendstunde, der Frieden schlug. Ist nun mit Gott gemacht, denn Jesus hat sein Kreuz vollbracht. Sein Leichnam kommt zur Ruhe. Ach, liebe Seele, bitte du, geh, lasse dir den Toten Jesus schenken. O heilsames, o köstlichs Angedenken.
That's Matthew Brook and the Dunedin Consort, directed by John Butt, singing Am Abend, da es kühle war, from the Matthew Passion.
Hearing that just brings me back. And it was always that arioso in particular, I felt a huge sense of responsibility to get the tone of it right. Knowing what's coming, of course, with the great aria Machadig that everyone loves, but there's something so particular and special to paint that stillness. It was the moment in the Matthew that I always, maybe not worried about, but I wanted to take particular care over.
Yeah, it feels, even amongst all this incredible, really kind of bafflingly incredible music, it's a really special moment. And like you sort of hint at there, it's really pivotal. It comes very shortly after the earthquake. Things in the Matthew don't tend to happen as quickly as in the John, but in musical terms, comes very quickly after the earthquake, just after the crowd sings in this A-flat major, which is the only time we get that key. It sings Wahrlich, dieses, what was it? This is the Son of God.
Yeah.
It always feels like to me the kind of turn of quite a serious corner into the kind of really quite surprising kind of joy of Machadig. Yeah, and it's I think the way that these emotions live so close by to each other, you know, pain and joy and all this kind of these kind of diametric oppositions, Bach always feels like he's saying that suffering is an enriching part of life. It's not a negative. It's absolutely necessary and absolutely makes our lives richer and better rather than something to be endured.
When you were talking about Aus Liebe, the soprano aria earlier, you talked about how the scoring of it is very particular with the flute, the two oboe to catch, no bass line. And this use of instrumentation, the orchestration of how he colours the arias, is one of the great joys, I mean, of the Matthew, maybe more than the John, perhaps.
I was just going through that in my head and wondering, I think the Matthew seems more orchestrally minded.
Yeah, more colourful. We said we weren't going to ask each other you know, if we had a preference between the two works. But certainly there might be preferred moments within them in terms of this sense of orchestration and colouring. One of my favourites, maybe a little controversially, because people often say that it's too long and it goes on a bit, but I absolutely love it, is Erwäger in the John the Tenor aria, which again is a kind of central moment, if you like. And this, it's talking about the rainbow and the, you know, the this sense of the eternal covenant between God and man. It's the shape of the vocal lines for the voice and the two viola d'amore as they literally depict, you know, the rainbow in the sky. There's this wonderful arc to it, and indeed to the aria itself in a sort of ABA form. It's a moment that always, provided it's that it's well sung and well played, I'm always delighted to hear it. And the space, the sense of that covenant stretching on almost to eternity, is perhaps painted in the length of the aria as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's the only bit really in the John, once the first chorus is out of the way, that sort of monumental first chorus, it's the only bit where Bach is happy to press pause really and say, for these, after Jesus gets scourged, you have this incredible bass recitative arioso asking you to consider how what heavenward guiding flowers spring from the thorns, and how a heart torn between grief and consolation, how suffering is your most precious treasure. These extraordinary words and extraordinary oppositions. And then, as you say, the tenor aria, both of these pieces with violas d'amore, which are an amazing colour, actually, to happen in the midst of such tension and sort of worked up music. The tenor aria is, I think, really special. The material from it comes from the scourging. So we get this, which is the sort of dactyl figure which we have in the scourging and we have in the Kreuziger. And in the aria, he uses the same rhythmic kind of emblem to mean salvation and redemption.
Nachdem hier was so
the tenor Matthew Beale with Collegium Novum, conducted by Edward Higginbottom, and their recording of the St. John Passion. There are those rainbow shapes there.
Yeah, there's amazing harmony in there as well, the way the harmony turns, this kind of sun comes out when he talks about the transformation of the wounds, the wheels on Christ's flesh into the rainbow of salvation. He's just able to do it with this a small musical gesture, but it's so telling and so profound, really. So the instruments that you can hear there are two viola d'amore, which is a very particular kind of string instrument. It doesn't look like a violin. And there's a lovely photo, I think, in John Eliot Gardner's book of a viola d'amore where it's taken from such an angle that the bridge looks like a rainbow. So there's a kind of synchronicity there. It's nice.
I love that. Yeah. And speaking of stringed instruments, brings us rather nicely to your preferred excerpt from the Matthew.
Yeah, so the thing I thought would be nice to hear was a little bit of the aria Comsus's Kreutz, which again is the singer who, in the score at least, sang the words of Christ, and is, I find it a wonderful aria. It's for viola da gamba and singer and continuo, so very, very small forces. There's a few musical things that's worth just pointing out. The viola da gamba really was, for Bach, seemed to be associated with death, really. Es ist vollbracht in the John, which is the moment where just after Christ dies, that's a viola da gamba obbligato part. Think of the early cantatas where he uses gambas as a real signifier of the theme of death. It's in D minor, which is a sort of key of nobility, and also the dance step, if you like, that Comsus's Kreutz is constructed on is a noble dance, a dance for kings and royalty. So we get already, before we've even started the music perhaps, we get a sense of a kingly death. So the music, like so often, Bach is able to kind of reveal to us a cosmic truth that we can't see, but the music tells us.
Ah. betragen.
Tantalizingly, relatively brief excerpt there of Komsuse's Kreutz with Matthew Brooke and the wonderful Jonathan Manson on the Dunedin's recording. Nick, you were just saying while we were listening to that about how, again, with this text, so schwer, that it's too heavy and the text, the tessitura of the vocal line comes down and then the sun coming out. It's, I mean, in a sense, it's word painting, which is seemingly quite sort of apparent and instinctive, intuitive, but it's done with such style and grace.
Yeah, to talk about it seems to trivialize it almost. But it's just so perfect. It's just so right for the words as the vocal line comes down, but the harmony also goes sort of southwards as he talks about how the weight of suffering is too great, too heavy. And then the words, so hilfst du mir, but you help me carry it. And the sun comes out and we go into B flat major, which is the key of Mache dich. So you're already towards salvation. But like, as I say, to articulate it just seems to lessen it somehow.
This is a conversation which could clearly go on for a very long time and already has done probably. So we've got to think about how we can start to wrap this up. I mean, a few things, you know, there are things that we've encountered, anyone who's performed these pieces will have encountered. You know, what size of performing forces we go for, there's a can of worms. And you can send us your thoughts on this, of course.
Send them to Eamon.
You know, we've both... thank you. Send them to Robert, actually.
That's right.
Yeah. We've had... You know, we've both experienced it doing it with, you know, large-scale forces, but also a much more intimate one to a part. Have you got a personal feeling? I don't think there's one right way of doing it. I know people can get quite militant about this, but I've enjoyed, you know, experience of any number of ways. Actually.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I think people do get quite worked up about it. I feel very privileged to have done it in lots of different ways: big choirs, big symphony orchestra, right down to just eight singers. Doing it one per part, I find, is a kind of on a human level very interesting. It's obviously tiring. It's obviously much more involving and grueling, if you like. Particularly the John, actually, for me, because there just isn't a let up. Those choruses are really full on. And
yeah. If you're evangelizing as well.
Yeah. I mean, this is quite a dull point, but if you're evangelizing between the end of Ich folge dir and Es ist vollbracht, you get one number off. So it's really full on.
Yeah.
So there's that, but that's only really a side concern, I think. Much more interesting is the fact that you're asked in these smaller forces things to shapeshift much more. You go from baying for blood to singing a chorale about forgiveness, often in the space of one beat. There are a couple of moments in the Matthew where the crowd is screaming for death and then singing a chorale of the faithful immediately afterwards. So there's a richer human experience there, which I think is interesting. I think for an audience it's nice to hear, or it's at least of interest to understand something theological about the fact that the person who, the sinner, if you like, the person who sings Peter's, the part of Peter, might also sing the part of Pilate and is complicit in different ways in the act of human frailty. Certainly in the Matthew, when you have Christ, the person who sang the words of Christ having died and then singing Mache dich, that gives us, again, a much more modern, really, concept of identity, humanity. So we can have people out the front and doing the solos, and that's lovely, and a wonderful big choir singing that first chorus, you know, is an incredible experience, really, to hear and be part of. But I think the music is so great, and Bach's understanding of the material is so profound, that whichever format we do it in, I think it really it illuminates a different kind of corner of the kind of great room of meaning.
The two pieces finish, I mean, very differently, actually. And this is how we're going to finish. Tell me about the end of the Matthew.
So a couple of things. The final chorus is a kind of great C minor saraband. So you've got this sense that the whole piece has been one structure from the G major chorale of the first movement. So the perfect cadence into the C minor of the final movement. C minor feels like a sort of funereal key. The penultimate chorus of the John is also in C minor. And previous to that in the Matthew, there's a kind of slightly unusual not clumsy exactly, but an unusual form where each of the solo singers from Choir One bids goodnight. John Butt calls it, it's goodnight from him and it's goodnight from me.
Yeah.
that's sort of the four Ronnies. But the one interesting thing about that is the way that the crown that we talked about, the crown of upper strings that Jesus had, which he loses when he sings about Eli Eli Lama Sabachthani, that's without strings. So in crying that God's forsaken him, he doesn't have the crown of divinity, if you like. That crown of strings is passed to the faithful, and they sing above that in that penultimate movement. And the choir too sings, "Mein Jesus will go to Nacht." So there's a real sense of valediction there. And then this monumental saraband where we sit down by the grave and just and weep, really, at the death of Christ. Like you say, the John is a different ending to the same story.
So the final chorus, if you like, of the John, again, is in a dance form. It's a dance form, Rutvol, and it's this wonderful sense of peace, sleep well, and almost putting Christ to rest. But then it has a chorale.
Yeah, it's a real coup, isn't it?
Which is the coup. Of course, one of the things that the conductor has to do is to remember that after the incredible emotional welling up of Rutvol, that we have to remember to conduct the chorus, the chorale after it.
I mean, I've heard two really, really distinguished conductors who've just kind of put their baton down at the end of Rutvol and had to be reminded by the leader, just, maestro, you know, one more to go, nearly there. Yeah.
Let's remember that this is a piece that was performed Good Friday, Vesper service, Good Friday. So this is before the resurrection. And yet in the John, the final chorale foreshadows the resurrection and finishes really on a very, very positive sort of triumphant, almost a triumphal note.
Yeah, exactly. Hugely positive, kind of perhaps send them out with a skip in their step. It's also about the way that Bach seems to understand that this is a story that goes beyond kind of conventional narrative. Of course, the congregation understands that the resurrection is coming. And so there's more than just narrative time, more sense of time in the Passions than just purely narrative. We have a sense of redemption that we know or we believe is near. We have a sense of further back. It's like that T.S. Eliot thing about the past and the future is all together in one moment. All time is present, sort of thing. And that feels like that, where we have this, again, very close by, this sense of laying someone to rest and also the redemption that's immediately after.
Nick, wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you so much.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
And for now, we're going to leave you, Choral to our listeners, with the final chorus from St. John Passion, with a recording by Edward Higginbottom and the Choir of New College, Oxford.
Oh. before you go, another reminder to try listening on Patreon, which costs just a few pounds per month. Or if you prefer, you can very simply make a one-off donation. You can actually do either via choralchihuahua.com. Thanks.